It's Wednesday, February 13th, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, loud calls of plagiarism against former New York Times editor Jill Abramson. She says it's a problem with some of the footnotes. Others, who she used to hold to a higher standard herself, tell her it's time to just apologize and right the wrong. We're also hearing from legendary sports broadcaster Bob Costas just a bit more than a year after NBC removed him from the Super Bowl broadcast for speaking, well, the truth. And growing troubles for journalists, reports of increased scrutiny over scrutiny of those covering immigration at the border, and a man wearing a MAGA hat reportedly shoved a BBC photographer at the Trump rally in El Paso Monday night. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today, but we're going to start with the many, many media angles of a story that's really continuing to develop almost a week in. The claims from Amazon and Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos that the National Enquirer was blackmailing him, threatening to publish racy text messages and photos unless he paid them a hefty sum. What exactly happened here for the Enquirer to be able to get these in the first place?
Well, I mean, one of the things that happened for them to be able to get it in the first place was that somebody leaked it to them.
And there was back and forth about who that somebody was.
Who that somebody was, what was his, you know, reasoning for doing that. And now you've got this issue where others who have been subject to these same sort of tactics by the National Enquirer they're coming forward. And so now, as you said, the story is just growing and growing and growing and growing. But to me, I mean, Bezos basically saying, nope, I'm not going to let this happen. I'm going to expose you. That's what really kicked it off.
Yeah, and there's it's interesting because the National Enquirer has actually done some really legitimate reporting on scandals in the past that we wouldn't have known about, most notably the enormous hypocrisy of John Edwards, the former presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. But so it's not like tabloids don't have their place, but the Enquirer is really well known for paying for tips and also for paying to for tips that they then squash. And that's what's really the issue here. This is a paper that has been allied with Donald Trump. The owner has made a plea bargain with one of the prosecutors who's investigating the Trump Russia connections. And so they have admitted to having quashed a scandal about Donald Trump. And now what Bezos is saying is, these people are after me because my newspaper, the Washington Post, has criticized the president. So it really has become a big national story because of that.
So that has led to another media angle, too, that idea that Jeff Bezos does own the Washington Post. An interesting choice on his part to publish this, to come forward with it, in Medium, a blog type of a social media platform that has more of a blog type interface where people can write and share their own content in that way, and choosing not to use the newspaper. It's an interesting choice. It's leading a lot of people to applaud the editorial independence that he's not using his newspaper as a mouthpiece for what is really a personal issue.
I think that's one of the reasons why he went that route as opposed to going to his own news operation to basically say, look, when I bought the Washington Post, I said that I was going to allow it to be independent, that I wasn't going to have any kind of influence on it. And then when a story like this breaks, he decides to go this route to basically show that what I said I was going to do is what I did.
But a lot of people say a lot of things. The fact that he actually walked the walk, it says something.
Yeah, well, and of course, Medium is kind of fits his persona as well. It's a site that's used by kind of tech savants. There are a lot of people who post things there. This is not a low profile kind of place. So people who are technically savvy read it. News people read it. So he wasn't really sacrificing much. I think he was giving the paper an opportunity to be independent. But of course, within nanoseconds after that post went up, everybody else was writing about it, linking to it, including the Washington Post. It's newsy.
So talk for a minute. How do you think the Washington Post has done in its coverage? It is in this very bizarre position of having to cover its owner.
I think it's done well. I mean, you don't get the sense, you know, I think one of the problems in being in this business is, you know, people always ask you about conflicts. And there really is no such thing for a journalist as a conflict-free zone. Mm-hmm. The question is, how do you handle it? And I think the Post has, they've done two things. They've covered this story hard and aggressively, and they've been transparent about his ownership of the paper in every single one of those stories. So, you know, every publisher has some interest that is at some point or another a newspaper is going to have to cover. And so I think the thing you do is you cover it, you try to be as fair and aggressive as you can be, and you try to be as transparent as you can be.
You know, I would agree with that. The other thing that I would say is that the both Bezos and the Washington Post have not followed, I guess, gone down the path of other news organizations that said, well, maybe this is a National Enquirer going after Bezos because of its alliance with Trump that you mentioned. And they're basically saying, oh, we've got something on you, so we're going to use this against you because of the way in which you've been aggressive in covering the Trump administration. In particular, the stories that the Washington Post has done involving the Mueller investigation. I mean, even when other newspapers are maybe putting it further down on their website feeds or below the fold, the Washington Post has consistently had the Mueller investigation at the top of its website, at the top of its newspaper, and been keeping pretty close tabs on that. So, you know, but they haven't said anything about that in their coverage of what's happening between Bezos and the National Enquirer.
This has been one of those stories that just on its face is salacious. There's no two ways about it. And the tabloids are going to be the tabloids. A headline last week and a front page that, given where and when this program runs, we probably shouldn't even say what it was because there's just innuendo at every turn. If you were to rate the quality of the coverage and being able to really just stick to the issues as they have developed because they are so nuanced, it is peeling back the layers of the onion, what would you say?
Par for the course. I mean, it's the environment we're in. Yeah. I mean, if you have a story like this, it's going to get covered differently depending on the news organization is covering it. I mean, you're going to have some of the celebrity tabloids that are going to cover it the way in which they've covered all scandals like this, and then you're going to have the national mainstream newspapers that are going to cover it the way in which they cover it.
So let's face it, sex sells. I mean, and the fact is, if you went to the average person out on the street here in Columbia, Missouri, and said, which would you rather read, a story that leads with the Washington Post's in love tryst, the Washington Post editor in love tryst, or is there a national security implication to this investigation? We know which lead most people would go for. So I think, but the fact is, if you, this story has both. It has a very serious national security implication. It's a very serious implication for public knowledge and public safety. How much knowledge is appropriate for the public to have of a public figure, and is it appropriate to do what the Enquirer did? Which I would say no. You don't. If you're a journalist and you go after a story, you get the story, you print it. In the case of Donald Trump, the National Enquirer did not do that. But when it came to Jeff Bezos, they were more than happy to roll this story out. And then when Bezos, I think the other thing that we haven't mentioned here that's important is Bezos charges that the Enquirer was asking him to walk back his allegation that there was a connection between the Enquirer's behavior and Trump, and specifically the very aggressive stance that the Post has taken on the killing of Jamal Khashoggi.
Right.
And so really what the Enquirer is saying is, we want you to say that there's no connection. We want you to walk that back. And then we won't print this stuff about you. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, that is a really, that's very disturbing, right, that a paper would kill a story and make that kind of an offer to kill a story, that is, we should say here, not what journalists should do.
No, right. Not what journalists should do. And you're providing a great segue into the topic that I wanted to talk about next, because the Trump administration did, in fact, go right through and blow a deadline that Congress had set for it to issue a report on the findings on the death of Jamal Khashoggi.
But are we surprised? I mean, I don't think we should be surprised by this. They pretty much, said that, look, this is the way we're going to handle this. We understand what Congress said, but we don't care what Congress said. And, I mean, the other day when they blew past the deadline, someone asked several congressmen what they thought about it. And they said, well, we can hold more investigations. We can try to limit funding. We can do all of these things. But really, there's not really much we can do other than those things. And so when you look at it, they'll have the investigations, which they're going to have anyway. They may try to limit some sort of funding. The Senate won't pass it. So you've got this stalemate. I mean, this has been the MO of the Trump administration, not just involving Khashoggi, but all other things when it comes to Congress. And I'm not surprised by it at all.
I'm not surprised, but it's also shocking. I mean, what's shocking about it, and I think this is what's important to really point out to our listeners and our viewers, and that is that what we've got here is the intelligence community of the United States of America have concluded that one of our allies in Saudi Arabia is implicated in the murder, probably ordered the murder of a journalist. In the past, that is the kind of thing that we could count on the United States government to be outraged about.
And to be at the forefront of trying to stop.
Yes, and to make it clear to our allies that this will not stand. Because the Trump administration is not doing this, it is having a chilling effect on journalists all over the world. I mean, we are hearing this over and over again. I'm the chair of Free Press Studies here. I've done a lot of First Amendment work for the National Press Club. And what we hear over and over again from journalists across the globe is that dictators are now feeling empowered because the president of the United States is not speaking out the way his predecessors have. There is no consequence for bad behavior in the world, and that is a bad thing for all of us as citizens.
And that was one of the things we talked about last week, is the result of the interview that he had done and sitting down with Arthur Sulzberger, the idea that he had no concept that his actions and his words could have that kind of an empowering effect around the globe.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is President Trump is playing to his base, and he's playing to his base here. He's in many ways come out and said, look, I am for what happens in the United States. I'm a nationalist, and what happens when it comes to foreign policy does not take precedent over what I think is important for us. And for him, the constant bashing of the media is not just a national thing. If it can help me to do it globally, I would do that as well, because it feeds to my base, and that's what I'm concerned
and
about.
We saw that feed to the base Monday night in El Paso. It's interesting to note, Kathy, as you were saying that, back in December, the U.S. became one of the top five most dangerous countries for journalists for the first time. And it may be because of incidents like what happened Monday night at the Trump rally, when a man who was wearing a Make America Great Again hat shoved a BBC journalist. The whole thing was caught on video. And this was another one of those rallies where the rhetoric was pumped up and we see that action happens.
Yeah, you had the media covering Trump's rally. Mm-hmm. You had him covering Beto O'Rourke's rally, which was going on at the same time. You had that dueling thing going on, and then when you have this sort of rhetoric going on, and I was reading the report this morning. It wasn't verified, but apparently this person may have been under the influence.
The attacker.
Okay. The attacker may have been under the influence before he jumped on the BBC reporter, but I mean, these are the things that happen at Trump rallies. I mean, it usually doesn't turn to violence, but there is a lot of shouting at the media. There is a lot of cursing at the media. And he whips this up. And then when it goes awry, he sort of pulls it back and says, well, you know, I'm not condoning that. Or people with his campaign will say they're not condoning
that. Well, and in fact, that's what happened at this rally. There was a big commotion when this happened on the press stand. And then it was such a big commotion that the president was aware of it. And he said, hey, is everything all right back there? Are you okay? So I think this is one of the things that I think, and this gets back to the last point about Khashoggi, too. Yeah. One of the problems here is that Donald Trump is a showman.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't think, you know, he would be the first person to visit that cameraman in the hospital if his arm was broken or something. But the problem is he doesn't understand that his words have consequences. And it's not the average person you're talking about, but it's the people who are hearing messages through their tooth fillings. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of people like that. And so by saying what he says, and to Donald Trump, it's just a political shtick, you know, and then he's going to go back and talk to the press on Air Force One going home, which he does. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't realize that that sends signals to people who are not completely balanced.
And it sends signals that it's okay for them to do these
exactly.
things and they can get away with it.
It greenlights it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so the point is, this is why political leaders, people who have leadership status in the community, really have to be a little more cautious. And I know President Trump and his supporters hate the idea of political correctness, but you know, there's a lot to be said for kind of putting a governor on your tongue every once in a while and not letting the first thing that pops into your head pop out of your mouth, because as I say, to you it may be political theater, to somebody else it's a call to action.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's switch gears a bit and go to Paris, France, where two journalists from the left-leaning newspaper Libération are suspended today after they were found to be part of an online boys club, I'm using air quotes there, that used a Facebook group to coordinate the harassment of female journalists, writers, and activists for nearly a decade. This group's existence was actually found on Facebook through a fact-checking group. I left Ernest speechless
again. You know, I read this and I went, why did it take so long?
Well, yeah, it was formed in 2009. We're looking at this being almost 10 years old that this group has been organized and had an organized effort to engage in cyberbullying against their female colleagues.
I mean, we're headed into year two or two and a half of the Me Too movement, and they just caught this. It's been going on for 10 years. And the other thing that I'm finding hard to believe is that, you know, was there no adults in the room? Could someone at the top of this organization say, whoa, wait a minute, this is not something we should be engaging.
Well, you're asking if there were adults in a secret Facebook group. My guess is the adults were purposely kept out of the room,
good point, virtual or real.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, isn't it reassuring to know that people stay young at heart, no matter how old they are? The thing that is stunning about
exactly can
exactly
straight through.
That's
into adulthood.
Exactly what. And what is interesting about this, and I think this is something that we as journalism educators deal with when we talk to students. There's something about the online experience that makes it really hard for people to get out of high school, you know? And there is something cliquish about it. That's certainly what you saw in the stories about the Ligue de LOL, you know, this group.
Their accent is better than mine, by the way.
It's just a very cliquish kind of us against them attitude. And to your point about the why did it take so long, I think this is the other interesting thing about people who are victims of bullies. Mm-hmm. They think it's just them. You know, what really made the Me Too movement take off was when one person spoke out and then somebody else said, wait, I wasn't the only one. Me too. So it really takes a while. I think that's what gives bullies their power, the sense that they're able to make the victims feel like they're the only ones and that they've been singled out, and they're ashamed to talk about it. That's why I think it stays undercover so long. And I don't know how we empower people to
Do you think
get
it's
past
also
that.
this still this belief that there's some sort of anonymity in social media when you put something out there. I mean, I remember those early days you had your own tag and no one knew exactly who you are. And there's still, I think that there's still this belief that I can put it out there and there's some sort of anonymity. And along with that is, I'm not looking at you face to face.
Oh, I think that's a big piece of it.
So, I can put this out there. I can type it and send it out into the social media, sphere. And somehow that's, being out there is much more protection than me actually being face to face with you. I think that's part of it as well.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And I think, that's one of the things as journalists, you have to face the people that you're going mm-hmm. to be interviewing or criticizing or judging. And it's a lot harder if you have to face those people. And that's a good thing, because it makes us double check and really be sure of what we're saying. But I think, really the social media phenomenon has empowered this sort of anonymous bathroom wall writing kind of stuff. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that people used to write on bathroom walls,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
And now they're putting it out there on a social site. And somehow I think this is something that we as a society have to grapple with. There's a lot of great aspects of social media and great aspects of digital communications, but like every technology, it has two sides.
Yeah.
And it's up to us and our generation and particularly our students' generation to say, how are we going to ensure that this technology is used for the good?
And to establish the norms to do that. You know how we all have words that no matter how hard we try, we can never seem to spell them correctly? Until relatively recently, one of my words was plagiarism. And it's many different forms. Well, not so much anymore. This week, there's another claim. This one is against former New York Times editor Jill Abramson. Looking at some of the passages from her new book, Merchants of Truth, she's been accused of not properly sourcing certain passages and certain quotes. And while she said that she's going to make some edits and fix some things, she maintains staunchly that it's not plagiarism. I'd like for you to take a listen to this excerpt from an interview that she did on CNN this weekend with Brian Stelter. To give it some context, remember that Stelter was a media reporter at the Times when Abramson was executive editor there.
This is a situation where, in fact, the Ryerson one that you showed earlier, that is credited in other footnotes. This was a case in which doing 70 pages of something that are called trailing footnotes, there are a few that dropped out, and I feel terrible about that. But Ryerson is credited, I think, twice in 70 pages of footnotes.
But even if I include a footnote, I still can't steal their words, word for word, the way that you
did. Well, if you give them proper credit, you can.
But not
in a book.
It doesn't matter if I put a footnote 300 pages later. If I do that in a book, that's plagiarism. That's word for word stealing of other people's work.
Well, that, that's your position. I don't see it that way.
But it meets the Harvard definition of plagiarism, and you work at Harvard. It meets the New York Times definition of plagiarism where you worked. You're saying you didn't plagiarize.
I'm saying that I made some errors in the way I credited sources, but that there was no attempt to pass off someone's ideas, opinions, and phrasings as my own.
So watching that live, I was just saying to Ernest, it was like I wanted to throw a sock at my TV. So I ask each of you, as scholars, as people who have had professional experience and careers working as reporters in prestigious newspapers, Ernest, as somebody who has written a book, is it plagiarism?
The way in which she did it, yes, it's plagiarism. I mean, when you go back and you look at the full passages that she took, she took them word for word. She did not give them the credit that they were due. If she had done that, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now, and she wouldn't be having to go back and make these changes. I mean, and to me, this continues to happen over and over again, and in some ways I blame the publisher, because the publisher should have saw this as well. And should have flagged this. I can't understand how many times a publisher is going to go through these kinds of issues before they say, wait a minute, if before we put this book out, we want to make sure that everything is done.
And there's software now that helps you do that. Yeah. It's easy. I think, this is one of the things that we talk about when we teach journalism students. This would have been something they would have gotten downgraded for, probably flunked for on a paper. It may not have been willful, but I think for the New York Times and former editor of the New York Times and somebody of Jill's status, and she is a great reporter. Mm-hmm. I was around Washington when she was and covered some things with her. She's a great reporter. But you have to own up to this. And you have to accept that this was a mistake. And if you don't, it reduces our credibility with the public, and this is not a time when we need to have that happen.
Okay, so before we go, we are running a little bit short on time, so I wanted to play for you a clip from an ESPN 30 for 30 documentary that came out this week with Bob Costas talking about NBC's decision about a year ago to remove him from the broadcast from last year's Super Bowl because he had been so outspoken about concussions. He says that NBC even acknowledged to him, and you can watch this clip on our links blog, acknowledged to him that they knew he'd said these things before, they'd been okay with it, but he couldn't do it for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I read the story, I watched the clip. He's right. Mm-hmm. This definitely happened. It's happened to other sportscasters. He basically took a stand, and because of the power of the NFL and the problems that they've continuously had with dealing with CTE and the repercussions of that, they basically pressured NBC into saying, we don't want him on the air because we're afraid of what he might say. And so they took him off. And that eventually led to him leaving NBC.
Yeah, this is a conflict between journalism and entertainment. And football is an entertainment module for the networks. It's a very profitable one. But they also have sports journalists like Bob Costas. And when he tried to be a journalist, it got in the way of the entertainment agenda. And that's a big conflict.
It is a big conflict. It's always an interesting debate that I sometimes let students fight it out, but I also give them kind of my opinions on this, that when the league or when an individual sports franchise has that much control over the broadcast, at what point do those faces or those people holding those microphones stop being journalists and actually become mouthpieces for the leagues or the teams that they're working for?
I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing more and more athletes become the face of the league on their broadcast and in their games, because they have that connection to them, and so the NFL still has a little bit of control there.
Okay, well, that music means we have run out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJ Oz, Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.